This is an interview with David and Diana Lett. They own Eyrie Vineyards. We are in their home, which is located at 4900 Bremen, is that it? Bremen Orchard Drive. Road, I'm sorry, Bremen Orchard Road in Dundee. Is that?
It's in the Red Hills of Dundee.
Okay, the Red Hills of Dundee, I would know, but I don't exactly know what where the boundary line is for addresses.
The township line is here in Dayton. Over at the vineyard, it's Dundee.
Okay, so
you've got 2 feet. In Dayton, we have two in Dundee.
2 feet and feet in different places. And today is the 3rd of January, 2003, and my name is Barbara Doyle. And so I'm going to ask these folks to give us a lot of information about their winery and the history associated with it. So starting with this list of questions that I have here, what got you into the wine business?
How long a story do we have here? Let's see.
I have 80 minutes of tape.
Okay.
But there's more than one question here.
Well, primarily, as I mentioned, I grew up in Utah, which is not exactly the locus of wine knowledge in the United States. Can you hear?
Yeah, I think it's coming out all right.
And I went to the University of Utah and took a degree in philosophy. And, well, I actually started in pre-medicine and majored in philosophy because I figured I was getting too much technology and too much science thrown at me with pre-med. And it needed tempering and interpretation. And so medical schools at that point were saying that they wanted liberally educated people. So when I applied to medical school back in 1961, I guess, after I graduated, I had a degree in philosophy and pre-medicine. They didn't want philosopher kings. So the medical schools I applied to, which were the best in the country, said no. So I had this useless academic combination. And I decided, I had a dentist in Salt Lake who was really good. And he talked me into applying to dental school, which I did. But I applied to dental schools in Maryland, Seattle, and San Francisco. Ones that were near the water so I could go sailing. That was how serious I was about dentistry. So... I guess I was having an interview in San Francisco at College of Physicians and Surgeons, which was a dental school there. Just on a whim, I drove up to the Napa Valley, and I guess it was January of 61, 62. Yeah. Was it 61 or 62? Let's see. Graduated in August 61. Would have been January of 62. And at that point, there were about three wineries in the Napa Valley that could be called... what would be called now super ultra premium or whatever hyperbole they use. And that was Mayakamas and Stony Hill and the old Souverain Cellars, which is now Burgess Cellars. And I went to Mayakamas and it was January and it was raining and I went up this muddy dirt road on the top of the Mayakamas range. And here's this winemaker out there with barrels out in the rain, stirring something, cleaning the barrels, doing something in it. You know, it's probably soaked, cold, and miserable. And I thought, my God, that looks romantic. So I met that fellow, Bob Sessions, and then went over to Souverain, where I met Lee Stewart, who was one of the pioneers in the Napa Valley of truly good, fine wine. And he had an Englishman named Gary Grosvenor working there. And Gary was working his way around the world from winery to winery. And he told me about UC Davis and the program there. So on my way back to Salt Lake, Donner Pass was closed. That was when it was a two-lane highway. Closed because of snow, and I stopped at Davis and said, hey, I've got this degree in philosophy and pre-dent, and I want to go into winemaking. And they said, yeah, sure. So I got this philosopher king thing again. So it took me a little while to convince them, and I enrolled in a master's program there and soon decided that I was going to be filtering white wine through little nylon beads for 2 years and doing some professor's thesis for him. So I changed and took a second bachelor's. Where I could.
In what?
In viticulture.
Well, was your master supposed to be in viticulture?
Well, it was going to be viticulture or enology, and I decided at that point, I came to Davis to learn about grapes. I knew nothing about grapes. I figured winemaking is something I certainly need to know about. I need the rudiments of it. So I majored in viticulture. That's the most important thing, where the wine comes from, the source, and minored in enology. So I took all the enology courses, but I majored in viticulture. And I graduated from Davis having all the prerequisites from pre-med and so on I had. I got through Davis in 2 years and went to Europe for about 9 months after that. Oh, yes. There is a backup on this. When I was at Davis, having grown up in Salt Lake, I didn't exactly know what Pinot Noir was. I didn't know what Bordeaux was. I didn't know where it was. But we had tastings, we had courses as part of the enology program, and I got exposed to Pinot Noir from Burgundy. At that point, there was nothing grown in California that resembled Pinot Noir. They called it Pinot Noir, but the federal law at that point was you only had to have 51% of the variety in the bottle to call it a varietal name. And Pinot Noir being light in color, a lot of people just blended in Carignan and Alicante and some of the old Italian varieties and called it Pinot Noir. There was no Pinot Noir business in California. So I tasted Burgundy and I got the real thing. And that was, you know, that was a divine revelation.
So Jason, our son, calls it the cosmic brick. Fell on his head.
Yeah. So I started researching climates where Pinot Noir might work besides the Côte d'Or and Burgundy.
So can I just interrupt? When you finished at Davis.
I wasn't finished then.
But you were planning to go into the wine growing business.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
That's why I went there.
All right. You planned to go into medicine, too.
Well, it was over my parents' protest. I got an offer from Lee Stewart. I should back up here. Can I do that?
Sure.
Okay. When I got back to Salt Lake, Lee Stewart offered me the job that Gary Grosvenor had had. And I was just hot to, you know, pack up my bags, get out of Salt Lake, and start at Souverain Cellars. And my parents, I was their only child, so they had all of their chips on me. So we had this discussion about dental school. My father said, why don't you go to dental school and, you know, make a lot of money, and then you can go do this hobby later on. Turns out he's probably right, but we don't admit that about our fathers when we're in our early 20s, right?
Or 30s.
Yeah, that's true. So I compromised and said, okay, how about if I go to Davis and take an academic degree in winemaking and grape growing? And we compromised. That was okay. So that's the backup. If you look at Pinot Noir, though, going back to Pinot Noir, it's grown in the Côte d'Or, which is about, what, 30 miles long and maybe 3 miles wide. That has been traditionally on this planet the only place where Pinot Noir could produce its pinnacles. And I started looking at, while I was at Davis, other regions around the world that might be cool enough for Pinot Noir because it demands a very cool climate. It's a fragile varietal characteristic in all Pinot varieties. And if it's not grown in a cool climate, the varietal characteristic, the character of the grape, boils out during the ripening process. Literally boils out. And you lose the flavors. So this cool climate of Burgundy is where Pinot Noir retained these flavors. So I started looking at the South Island of New Zealand on paper, northern Portugal, where we have some grapes planted now at a friend's place, near Ponta de Lima in northern Portugal, and the Willamette Valley. And the Willamette Valley kept coming up as the place. But I went to Europe for 9 months after that just to sort of confirm this idea about why grapes are grown where in Europe. And if you go to someone in Bergen, they'll say,
I'm going to stop it.
Okay.
Here we are. We're in business.
Where was I?
You were talking about the rationale for Pinot Noir.
Yeah.
The pomology department at Davis is in the same building as the viticulture building. And there was one book, and I can't remember the name of it for the life of me. It was talking about growing fruit in cool climates. That's where you retain flavors in fruit, all sorts of fruit. Okay, that's beside the point right now. I'm in Europe, and I was there for 9 months, and I went everywhere from Austria to Portugal. But primarily concentrating on France, and I'd ask people, why is this particular variety grown here? Why do you grow Pinot Noir in Burgundy? You just barely make it to maturity every year. Some years are wipeouts. It's a difficult grape to grow here. Why do you do it? And the answer was because this is, well, number one, the answer was, c'est tradition. But if you look at it, it's where the grapes kept the flavor. And if you go to Bordeaux, you could plant Pinot Noir in Bordeaux and ripen it every year. You could plant the Bordelais varieties in Rhône, in the Rhône Valley, and ripen them every year. No problem. Just getting grapes ripe is not the point. Retaining the flavor in the grapes is the point. So after having my theory sort of confirmed by the fact that certain selected varieties are planted in Burgundy, certain ones in Alsace, certain in Champagne, Bordeaux, and in the Rhône Valley, where they just fit the growing season. The varieties in the Rhône Valley, you could never begin to ripen here or in Burgundy. But they ripen at the end of the growing season in the Rhône Valley. They're very late maturing varieties, and they fit the climate, and they retain the flavor. That's the whole symphony. That's how it plays out. So, with that knowledge in hand, and having done the previous research, I came back to California and got cuttings of Pinot Noir and related varieties, which all fit a amphlographic formula.
What kind of formula?
Well, a grape amphlography describes a grapevine or the characteristics of the leaf and the growth characteristic and the ripening period. The most important thing to me was the ripening period. And these were all what is called period one varieties, or the earliest ripening varieties. And that would include Pinot Noir, Pinot Gris, Pinot Blanc, Aligoté that grows in Burgundy, Pinot Meunier, which grows in Champagne, Gewürztraminer, which grows in Alsace, and Riesling is a period two variety. It ripens 10 days later, theoretically, than the Pinot varieties. But I thought it would work here. So with that knowledge, I went to California and I gathered up cuttings.
Where did you get the cuttings?
Dependent. The Pinot Noir I got from Wente Brothers Greenfield planting down in the Salinas Valley. It was one of the first plantings down there. And it was all virus-free material from UC
Davis. So that's outside of the Napa Valley area.
No, that's south. That's just inland from Monterey.
Yeah, that's what I thought. So this isn't the wine-growing area of the Napa Valley?
No.
Okay.
I took Chardonnay cuttings from a friend's vineyard in the Napa Valley where Lee Stewart had made some of the most spectacular Chardonnay in California. So I took cuttings from selected vines in what's known now as the Draper Selection. It was a selection I made with the vineyard foreman at the Draper Ranch in the Napa Valley. Riesling, I think I got also from the Draper Ranch. Pinot Gris wasn't grown anywhere in the United States, nor was Muscat Autonel, which is an Alsatian variety. And
Portland.
Pinot Meunier was not grown anywhere in the U.S. Pinot Blanc was misnamed by Davis. What I brought up here as Pinot Blanc is now called Melon. I don't even think it's Melon. I think it's a clone of Chardonnay. There are a number of reasons for that, and I can go into them, but I won't. Any rate, suffice it to say, I went to my major professor at Davis and said, I will prune the Pinot Gris and the Pinot Meunier and the Muscat in the variety collection. They have four vines from of every variety from around the world. So I pruned these vines and I took the cuttings and brought them up here. And it was about 160 cuttings per variety.
So the cutting is what you get when you prune the vines after the harvest.
Yeah, you prune it into a stick, maybe a foot long, put it in the ground to root, and that becomes your...
Oh, you didn't need a rootstock?
We planted, there was no phylloxera in Oregon then.
Right.
And it was my feeling that if people are not either dumb or greedy, we don't have to have phylloxera here. Well, you know what's happened. We're still on our own roots, and I'm still planting vines on our own roots, but that's a whole other story. That's the way we grow grapes here. I think that the vine should dictate its own destiny. A rootstock is a man-imposed thing, and it changes the characteristic of what happens up above, the scion that you graft onto the rootstock. That's a whole other story. How many hours do you have? How many hours do I have?
Well, 80 minutes on this, but I can always come back with another disc.
So I gathered up all these cuttings, and in January of 65, actually late December, I started off from California. We had the worst flooding. Were you here then?
No.
We had the worst flooding in the Willamette Valley. I got to Eugene.
You had never been to Oregon.
I had never
either.
Been to
you
Oregon.
Set eyes on Oregon.
This was all on paper.
All right.
I had studied the climate and looked at the soils of Oregon. Climate was the most important thing for me. And I got to the Willamette Valley, and the I-5 had just been completed up from Eugene. And it was a lake. I mean, there was this ribbon of freeway and a lake on either side. The place was totally flooded. You can go along the Wilsonville Road now. And I think there's still some marks on some of the old trees where the water level was. It's as high as it's.
Yeah, I think I've seen a couple of those.
It was a great,
wondered about
great
that.
Beginning.
They weren't kidding about raining up here.
It was an amazing beginning, so. Golly, what was the next part of the sequence?
Well, you had all these cuttings, and then you came up here, but you didn't bring the cuttings with you, did you?
No, they came up. They came up separately. I shipped them up. But they, right after that, so in March, I looked around. I found a place to live over in Silverton across the valley because I loved the village. It reminded me of an Alsatian village. And there's a church up at the top of the hill with a steeple, yeah. And then you go down, and it was just a charming place. And I saw all these other places around where, you know, there were overturned cars with blackberries growing out of them and goats chewing clothes off the line and stuff. And Silverton was sort of nice. So I looked around the area around Silverton initially. That's where I was going to plant. And I couldn't even find a piece of ground to rent to put the cuttings in. So I found a place outside of Corvallis through a friend of mine. And we put in, I planted the 3,000 sticks there. And then took a job in a berry nursery in Salem. This was in March of 65 now. And I went into this berry nursery, Weeks Berry Nursery in Salem, and I walked in 25 years old, knowing everything. I had two college degrees, and I said to the guy, I know plants and yada yada, I have a degree in plant science and blah blah. He said, you're way overqualified for anything I have for you. And I said, yeah, but I'm hungry. So he put me to work for 75 cents an hour bundling blueberry cuttings in the shed. I was later promoted to tractor driver because I've been driving tractor in Salt Lake since I was 12 on my family's farm. So I got $1.25 for that. And I just saw Wayne Weeks last week, actually, in McMinnville. And I reminded him of the 75 cents an hour. And he said, yeah, and I think you were overpaid.
I think you should say that little plot that you had down in Corvallis was rented.
Yeah.
And it was just all the grape cuttings were planted real tight together in little nursery rows. It was just to start getting them rooted and protected.
Good point. So then I started the search, or let me move on. I started looking around for land in the Silverton Hills, as I mentioned. And everything was in huge acreages then, and I simply couldn't afford it. I mean, I didn't come from one of these wealthy backgrounds that
Yeah, that's one of my questions in here.
No, wine was not a plaything. I came up here with the specific purpose and idealism to make wine. And I was quoted in the Wall Street Journal a number of years ago as saying, I came here to make wine, not money. And it's worked.
Pinot Noir.
All right, we got to stop again.
That's pretty non. Cool, Matt.
Okay, we're back in business.
Where am I? Silverton, living there. Okay, so I couldn't find the land over in Silverton. And then this job was obviously not going to support this venture. And a friend of mine was in college textbook publishing. He told me about a job that was available as a textbook representative for Scott Forsman Company. It was coming up in June of that year. So I applied for the job, and strangely enough, they hired me. And this was a job that gave me an academic year to work. I mean, I had 3 months off during the summer. I had Christmas vacation, and I had spring vacation, just like, because I couldn't call on any colleges, they were all closed down. So that gave me time to work the vineyard. The pay was not good, but, and I traveled.
Better than $1.25.
It was better than $1.25.
Got a car.
But slightly. I got a car and I traveled 4 states. I did Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and Alaska. And then they threw in Northern California after that. Kept trying for Hawaii, but somehow the sales manager kept that. Any rate, while I was going to and from colleges, I carried an auger in the back of my car here in the Willamette Valley. And I started, or, you know, finding a likely looking hillside, and I'd go up and ask permission if someone was there, and if someone wasn't there, I'd just go do it and dig and take a little soil sample to see how deep the soil was. And I spent almost 2 years looking for the right piece of land. I avoided the Dundee Hills like plague because the houses were already happening in Dundee. Give some water. Please. So I stayed away from the Dundee Hills. I figured this was going to be overrun with subdivisions. And the grape land, the prime grape land, would be gone. In those days, it was prior to Senate Bill 100 and land use planning in Oregon. And the scenario was that all of the agriculture land was in the valley floor where the soils were rich and good. And that's true. And hillsides were destined to be view lots. But this piece of land where we're sitting, not quite, just over a few, about a quarter of a mile from here, came up for sale. It was 20 acres. It was perfect. The right elevation, the right slope, the potential for water, for the winery I was going to build there. And this was in 1966.
Oh,
at this point. And the land came up for sale, and I bought it. This was in...
What did you pay approximately per acre?
$485 an acre.
Okay. What was on the land that you were buying?
It was a blown-down prune orchard from the Columbus Day storm.
Okay.
And I
so the owner was anxious to kind of get out.
Yeah, it was sort of lying fallow, and it had been for 4 years since the storm. And I pulled out each tree with my little Ford 8N tractor to save $200 that I would have spent on a caterpillar to come in and root the whole thing out in about 3 hours. So I spent $200 replacing the clutch on my 8N tractor.
Don't forget the poison oak.
And the poison oak that I got internally from wrapping chains around the trees. But the nice thing was that fall I got sent back to a sales meeting.
It was that summer.
Was it summer? Uh-huh. Yeah, it was. That's right. It took that summer prior to buying the land. I was sent back to the home office in Chicago for the, quote, new man's meeting of Scott Forsman employees. And one of the new men was Diana, who was working in the Dallas, Texas office as a college service representative. She was the backup to the guys who were out in the field. And so we met, and she proposed to me 3 days later. No,
you can contradict
it. I proposed to her 3 days later.
What did you propose, David?
Well, that's another story. And we were married 6 weeks later. Over the protests of her mother, who said she would spend more time picking out a dress pattern than a husband. And we flew up to, I guess we were married October 1st. And at that point I had bought the land, and we flew up here, and just to get the ball rolling, we started digging a few rootings out from the nursery down in Corvallis and healing them in up here. And we started,
so by healing them in, you're still not putting them into the vineyard.
In the ground. We planted a few vines in 1966 just to get our land planted with some grapes. Most of the planting was done in 1967 and 68. And that took us up to about, from an original 4 acres of 68, we planted another 3. So we had 7 acres, and that was about all I could handle with the traveling, and we had 2 young children.
So this, you were working for Scotts Forest,
for
several years.
For 8 years.
Okay. Okay, well, that kind of answers one of these questions in here.
Yeah, I'm not following the pattern.
No, but that's all right. I mean, I just said, you know, buying land, having to wait, buying the what you need to plant and the machinery you need in order to operate the place, and then so many years before you see a dollar of income coming out of it, you need to have some economic support behind you. And
you're either a corporate giant and you come into
right,
this
yeah.
for a hobby, or else
right,
you
right.
Yeah. Or else you go to a lot of farm auctions and buy used pole bean wire and used pole bean stakes. I have some end posts out here that are clear grain cedar that are still in the ground. They've been there since 1967 with no treatment.
I mean, all these people who have, you know, deep roots in this area because their pioneer ancestors came here 1840s and 50s, they should love you because your story is the same.
I don't think they know the story. I think what was another interesting aspect of this was, since there was no wine business at all up here or grape mm-hmm. growing, and not a whole lot going on down in the Napa Valley.
No, there was Richard
the scale
Summers
was
down
different
in Hillcrest
yeah.
and Napa. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say there wasn't a lot of stuff you could draw from. Everything sort of had to be jury-rigged or kind of searched out, or you had to get it from someplace else that was more exotic than just going over here to Oregon Vineyard Supply and picking up what you needed, you know. And everything was more difficult and less available. So it made it a lot more interesting.
It was. It was fun. It was fun to go to farm auctions. I mean, Dick Erath, Dick came up in 1968. We went out. I remember a farm auction in Gaston where we were bidding on a stainless steel milking bucket. And I finally won the bid at $3.
You incremented the bidding by 5 cents?
Yeah.
That was our pump, probably.
But I bought most of my equipment at farm auctions. I mean, there were a lot of pole bean farms that were going on.
I was just going to say, but that would imply that some of the agricultural activities that had been sustaining this area were dying out.
Well, they were going to bush beans instead of pole because they were less labor intensive.
Okay.
So all this trellis wire, I bought trellis wire for 2 cents a pound in reels. It was great. Stakes were 25 cents. I mean, end posts were 25 cents. A stake was 2 cents. I still have some of the... We have some fencing made from some of those old cedar stakes. And I guess then what did we do? We moved from...
Well, we had 2 children in rapid succession.
kind
of surprised.
We had one in Silverton. We had moved from our original apartment. Mm-hmm. And we lived in Silverton. I was commuting across the Wheatland Ferry over here in the summer times to work the vineyard. And if I forgot a crescent wrench and the tractor broke, you know, I was going over to my neighbor all the time. Thank God for my neighbors. So I'm sure Ted Wirfs and Roy Wirfs were a couple of brothers who owned farms adjoining us here. And they thought, I know they thought, this guy is nuts. But he's a nice kid. We'll help him out.
They were so sweet. Pulled them out of the mud many a time.
Jeez. So then we moved to Carlton. now a locus of the wine industry again. But I'll tell you, Carlton back in 19, what was that, 69?
We went down there in 1969, yeah, early 1969.
I used to walk down the street with my beard, which I grew, by the way, because I got carded when I moved up here. I was 25 years old. I figured I needed to look older. But I'd walk down the street in Carlton, and there'd be a guy in the barber chair, and the barber would wheel him around so I could look at the hippie walking down the street. And Diana, bless her heart, when she's pregnant with Jason, gets one of these craves one Friday night. She wants to have baklava and 7-Up. Well, where do you get baklava in Carlton in 1969?
I didn't expect it. I just wish I had it.
I went up to Junie's Tavern, which was where the loggers all came down out of the hills to fight each other on Friday nights. And I walked in there with my beard. I didn't ask for baklava. I said, "Do you have a 7-Up?"
That was tasted so good.
But now that is, what are there, 7-5 wineries over there now?
There's quite a few of them. Yeah. They've opened up some kind of joint winery over there. Press and storage and all that.
I think something like 10 or 15, it just right in that little area. So anyway.
And McMinnville has, what, 10 now, I think?
Well, that, you know, that folder that comes out in the Oregonian for the holiday weekends when wineries are open, 65 in Yamhill County.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, I mean, it seems
like it was
like
a lot lonelier here before.
Well, it was very lonely at the beginning, wasn't it?
And we could hold growers' meetings in the bathroom.
But what was the reaction of the people when you came here?
Pretty much as I said. I mean, you know, I was a young idealist. And I grew up on a farm, but, our family income didn't come from the farm. My father was in the insurance business. But, you know, I had some agricultural background. I knew how to drive a tractor and a disc and stuff like that, but... You know, this was seat of my pants. I was 25 years old, and I had 2 college degrees, and I knew everything. I mean, this is...
Okay, so you were insufferable at that point.
Probably, yeah.
But enthusiastic.
But my neighbors were great.
Okay, so, I mean, I just see it as a fairly close community that you came into, in the sense that...
Pretty much, but they thought, this kid's nuts, but let's help him out before he fails.
Okay. But that was just, our immediate neighbors. I mean, yeah. I think...
No one else knew we were here. The hell, the Chamber of Commerce didn't know we were in McMinnville with a winery for 20 years.
Oh.
And speaking of winery, one of the reasons...
I got to change this.
Okay. So, wineries we were starting to talk about. We had... In 1969, knowing that we were going to have our first crop in 1970, we had a winery design.
So you planted some of them in 68?
66, 67, 68.
Oh, okay, this was when they were down in Corvallis.
No, this was here in the
66, okay.
65, early 65 in Corvallis. And then when we moved them up here.
Okay, I have a little trouble remembering the sequence of these things,
yeah,
but okay.
It's all right, ask those things because they're important. Because these sequences get screwed up. 65, I came up here in January of 65. Okay. We planted the cuttings in March, moved the cuttings up to a friend's barn in early autumn of 66. And in 66, 7, and 8, we planted vines. Here on this property.
Okay, so you moved into this house then?
No.
This house was in Carlton.
We were in Carlton. This house was and land was not part of the original purchase. And I said to Diana, if that house on the road, that dump on the road ever comes up for sale, even if we get ripped off, we're going to buy it. Because we were down to going to put in a mobile home down at the winery site.
Or
a pad, a wood house.
Something
or other. But this house, I think Diana drove up the road the next day and there was a for sale sign on it. And it took the name Chateau Debris, which Diana gave to it a long time ago.
Took it to new heights. But tell about the first crop coming in and we're going to build a winery down at the vineyard.
I had the power run in, we had a well, we had wonderful water for cleaning up the winery and so on. I had a gravity feed winery design because I had seen a gravity feed winery in Europe when I was there. And I thought, this is the way to go. Of course, Now it's the in thing,
yeah,
of the late 1990s. But, you know, gravity's been around a heck of a lot longer than some of the new kids,
mm-hmm,
even longer than me.
Gravity's been around forever, practically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Keeps us grounded.
So we got an architect, and we have beautiful plans drawn up.
It's a neat winery. I still have the plans.
Mm-hmm. And so where would the building have been on these 20 acres that you bought?
Yeah, on the original 20 acres.
And the access to it would have been off of
99. Up what is now Silver Blossom Lane.
Uh-huh.
They weren't here then. That was all Worf's property over there, and that was orchards.
Orchards growing what?
Oh, cherries, peaches, walnuts. What else did they have?
That was pretty much it. It was incredible peaches.
Yeah. But as 1970 churned along, and I was going to every lending institution possible, and finally got my millionaire uncle in Chicago to guarantee a loan for me, and I took it to the bank here in McMinnville, locally owned bank. And the guy said, Chicago, that's way too far away. We won't take a loan from anyone that's guaranteeing it that far away. And I went to the small business minister. I went everywhere to try to get some money to build this winery. We needed $30,000 for the initial stage of it. And by August of 1970, it wasn't happening. And I had bought some 30 new French oak barrels and shoved them in an old abandoned turkey processing plant in McMinnville. Just put them in a room in there. There was no electricity working in the building, but I had a flashlight. I knew that the room was cool, and I just put the barrels in there. So in August, I went over to, it was Jim and John McDaniels.
Were they the folks who had the granary?
Okay. Yeah, exactly. And they owned this old building. They had used it for egg candling, and it had gone through many incarnations since being a turkey plant. Swift and Company. You know, we used to grow a third of the turkeys in the country. You did the interviews on this.
Oh, yes, yes. An industry that went from almost nothing to very significant to bust.
Yeah.
Well, we had one of the that was built by Swift and during World War II, wasn't it?
Part of it in World War II, and then they added on in the 50s. But in August, I went in there and with a flashlight and started looking around in this room where the barrels were, with 5 inches of cork insulation, a drained floor. And I thought, hey, and there was air conditioning. I thought, this will work. So we scrapped the plans of trying to build a winery.
So, why did you establish the winery in McMinnville?
Necessity, the mother of invention.
We had no money, and they weren't going to give us any, and they thought we were hippies.
I went over to Jim, and I said, would you rent me that room? And he said, well, yeah, $25 a month. I said, it's okay. So
you had just one room there?
We had one room in this 8,000 square foot building. It was 25 by 40.
Now, I'm just curious. This is the building that you're in now?
Same building.
With added space, though.
Yeah. I bought an old basket press from Richard Summers down at Hillcrest. It was about to break his back, so he passed it on to me.
A basket press is
It's
one of these things that you turn like this.
Well, this had a hydraulic ram on it.
It goes down. Okay.
It's essentially a design that goes back to the Romans. Paid him $100 for that. We had the 30 new French oak barrels. They were $50 a piece, landed on our dock from France. I put a pump together from 3 broken pumps over at Allen Fruit Company in Newburgh. Kenny Allen was a great help.
And I keep hearing that name coming up, too. So
Kenny?
Yeah.
Well, that's where
he got
behind
the wine folks real early.
He did. And he used to loan me my fermenters, which were cherry brining bins. And those things are used all over this industry now.
All right, let me ask, is he still alive?
No. Unfortunately. Right. He was a great guy. Let's see, I guess I bought some hoses new, transfer hoses. Ed Gormley, the night before we started harvesting, was crawling around the attic of this building, connecting up pipes so we could get water down into the room that I was renting. And we had a winery put together. We had a crusher stemmer. It was hand crank. I had an old furnace motor. I motorized it. And we put that winery together for about $2,500 in equipment. And it functioned.
Very creative.
Now, I mean, this was a place to press your grapes, fermenting them. bottling them.
Storing and bottling.
And storing the barrel, and storing it in barrel. Well, the bottling.
We didn't have, to think about the bottling. Yeah, that was a couple of years ago.
We bought the building in 1973, and it was a derelict. I mean, I won't even go into the gory details of it, but it was a dump. It was scheduled to, you know, just fall into oblivion.
So how many acres of grapes did you have by the time you were going over there?
We had the original 7 acres. Because I was still working for Scott Forsman. In 73, I quit Scott Forsman. And because of corporate shakeups in Chicago, and I knew I wasn't going to last very long. But that's a whole other story, too.
Yeah, it was. We had reached the point where there was so much to do that we couldn't grow this if we stayed with that. Mm. And we couldn't stay with that because there was too much to do here. And we had our two little boys, and everything was...
Yeah, I wanted to see my kids once in a while instead of being out in Pullman, Washington, peddling textbooks and things.
Yeah, and one of our children had significant special needs, so, you know, we had to give a lot of attention to the family also. So,
it's tough times.
We had a full plate. So
you know, that little thing in the Boys Up North about Jerry, didn't mention him, but the guy who ran the gas station in Dundee, that I was purported to have said, if you send anyone out, anyone to the house to talk to us, I'm going to stop buying gas here. You know,
I don't remember.
That sort of fits. That sort of makes me the curmudgeon.
Well, yes.
Well, there's a reason. We had an autistic son. We had another son right behind him. I was selling textbooks, and we had romantics coming out of the woodwork, knocking on the door saying, can I pick your brain for an hour or so?
There were only two or three people here growing grapes then by the mid-70s, so everybody wanted to come.
Well, sure,
you couldn't spread
it
around.
You were a wise old sage, even if you weren't old.
Grapes for hours.
So time was a little bit precious. But when I quit in 73, we had our first crop. We had the 1970 vintage in bottle by then. And I went out, Diana went out, and we tried to sell this wine. I came here to make the Great American Pinot Noir. The wine was so disappointing because I made all these mistakes the first year. I followed my Davis education instead of my intuition. I fermented it too cool, I picked too early, and the wine was nothing. So we didn't even call it Pinot Noir. Diana came up with the name Oregon Spring Wine. And we said a light, dry wine for all informal occasions. It was $265 a bottle, and it took us 3 years to sell 200 cases of it.
Wasn't a quick reception we thought we were going to have.
I had a mailing list from Bert Harris's store up in Portland. Bert sort of trained Portland in wine drinking. So Bert gave us his mailing list, 400 people, and we mailed out to them, and we did a nice brochure. As a matter of fact, a guy in advertising said it was the best winery brochure he'd ever seen. We mailed this to 400 people, figuring we're here.
200 cases, 400
yeah.
people.
You know how many responses we got?
Two.
That's a little high.
Okay.
We got one.
One.
After a careful count, we determined, and a recount. And there were no dangling whatever they are. So no chance there. One customer, and that was it. And I knew it was going to be uphill marketing.
Now, at this point, are you still working with Scott Forsman?
No.
So there's no income coming in, and there's basically zero sales.
Yeah. It was a little sticky.
I guess we had a little bit of savings. I don't know. I can't even remember.
I didn't have any savings. My mother died in 65, and she left me $10,000, and I bought the land with it. You know, most people would have been smart and gone to a bank and got it financed. I just took all of the money we had in the world and threw it into that land. It's fine. We own it. And the rest is a blur until 1980 to me.
Yeah. The 70s are lost. I don't even remember that. But a lot of people were beginning to come up here.
But now you've acquired more land. From those original 20 acres?
Not at that point. We were still wanting to... We started planting up. When did we plant this block? We bought this house in 1970.
And we planted this home 5 acres in 1973.
73.
And, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So your plantings now came from cuttings from your own lawns.
Right, yeah, yeah. We get propagated.
No,
oh, wait, oh, in the meantime, oh, one of our big money-making things was to make
in
a greenhouse
and
a little nursery and all that, and that was a way to get more exercise, but I don't know that we made any money.
No, we got frozen out one year. I had a whole bunch of plants ready to go. Jim McDaniel had paid for them. He was planting a vineyard, and they froze in the barn.
So there were other people coming here and planting, so we were trying to, you know, make some money from
selling. So some people would take cuttings from your...
Mm-hmm.
I sold cuttings and I sold rootings.
Okay.
That we had rooted. And
can you give me the names of some of the people who might have been coming here and doing that?
Well, sure. You know, Herath came up in 68, and then there was what...
Did he come to you for any cuttings?
I think Dick got some cuttings from us.
Some, I can't remember.
Yeah. Most everyone has. I mean, Pinot Gris, we made the first, you know, planting of Pinot Gris in the United States commercially. So it wasn't a very popular variety. So most of the Pinot Gris that's around here now came originally from this site. All of the Melon or Pinot Blanc came from this site. The Vadensville clone that I brought up here came from, you know, a lot of the wood that's around Oregon, a lot of the plants around Oregon are originally from this site.
Okay.
And certainly most of the Pinot Gris.
So who were some of the earliest winery?
Adelheim, Ponzi, Sokolblosser.
Okay, and were they all bought something from you?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Very much.
All right.
Either bought or gave it to him. Amity.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there was a lot of that. The source of a lot of the material was here. Erath got in the nursery business with Chuck Corey later on, and they disseminated a lot of material also. But the real, the thing that turned things around, we were just scratching to get by.
All of us.
All of us, yeah, really.
Nobody came out here with big bucks in the 70s.
But in 1979, a friend of mine in Burgundy said, this French magazine, Gomio, is going to do a tasting of American Pinot Noirs vis-a-vis French Pinot Noirs from Burgundy. And she said, send some over, and I'll put them in. And so Becky put them in, and we did. We came out third with one group of judges and not so well with another group, but we were the first American Pinot Noir to show anything in France. It was sort of like back in 1976, Stephen Spurrier did a tasting of Gurgage Hills and Stag's Leap, Gurgage Chardonnay and Stag's Leap. This put California on the map.
I'm going to tell you right now, when you get this index, there's going to be a lot of misspellings of these foreign
names.
That's
okay, names. We'll do that. Okay. But this was a big tasting in Paris, and all of a sudden, California wine had credibility. So here then, 2 years, 3 years later, they did another tasting in France, and this time it was
Pinot Noir.
Lo and
behold, Pinot Noir had credibility. Instead of this small little acreage in the Côte d'Or in Burgundy, there was, lo and behold, another place in the world that grew Pinot Noir. Robert Drouin, who has Domaine Drouin, Oregon now, was rightfully enraged at the tasting because the supplier of the Burgundy wines was not a very good negociant. The wines were peripherally good. Robert said, if my wines had represented France, the honor of France of Burgundy would have been upheld. So he called a rematch using the same judges, same wines, the next year in Beaune.
Against his wines.
Against his wines, and he hand-selected some pretty darn good vintages. And there was no question. We came in second by 0.2 of a point out of 100 points against his 59 Chambeau Musigny. And that hit the Herald Tribune, the International.
So we're talking in 79, and he's got 20-year-old wine that he's putting
in,
and you've got fairly recent
vintage. Yeah, we've got 5-year-old.
This was our 1975 vintage, and it's the same wine that had been in Paris the year before. And this wine, which, by the way, is still very much alive and lovely,
And expensive, I'm sure.
It placed second out of all these wonderful Burgundies, and we clobbered the rest of the competition. I mean, California was nothing. And all of a sudden, Oregon had credence. And you know the strange thing, and this is an aside, Mike Gergich and Warren Winarski, who had done Cabernet Sauvignon and Chardonnay and shown that California could do these things in Paris, these guys and I had all worked for the same guy, Lee Stewart.
Oh.
There's a connection.
That. There is a connection.
You guys should do that while you're all still making
wine. That's part of my visit to California this year. Any rate, it hit the press around the world about this win in Beaune, because Gomio Republic.
Now, we're talking what I would say, Beaune, Germany? Or
no, Beaune, France.
The heart of Burgundy, the heart of Pinot Noir.
Okay.
That's the heart of the Côte d'Or. And I was getting calls from Hong Kong to Jamaica, wanting the 75 wine. And I sold a few bottles of it, and I figured this is just press hype, so I'm not going to charge an immense fee for it. So I charged $20 a bottle, which was, you know, high enough, but not too high then. And people bought it, a few bought it, and then I pulled it off the market because it was so good and I made so little of it. That's another story.
Well, we weren't sure what we should do about it.
Well,
I should have capitalized on it more than I did, but actually the press took care of it. From then on, Oregon was moving.
But as you were making your wine, and I mean, we've got the 75 vintage that's really good, and then you only get that accolades in 79. So what are you doing with the wine that you're making? Is it selling locally, or are you having wine with lunch and dinner in the evening?
Yeah. When we first came up here, we were drinking C.K. Mondavi out of gallon jug, so, you know,
we defined the word schlep. We're schlepping it everywhere.
We took it. Diana would go and deliver in Portland and, you know, schlepping or slipping on lettuce through the kitchens, delivering a case of wine here and a case of wine there.
Were you selling it? I can't remember. Were you selling up any in Washington? And
Where was the here and there that you were selling it?
That's me. Jerry, oh gosh, restaurants aren't even there anymore.
Okay, so you would go to these places.
Yeah, in Portland I was doing that, yeah.
And introduce yourself, and here's, would you like to try that?
I remember one chef of a very nice restaurant. Remember Belinda's?
Oh yeah.
And that guy refused to talk to any woman about wine.
Deb Hatcher got the same treatment.
She got yelled at, but this was just recently for her. Yeah,
he was not
going to discuss wine with any woman.
You should have just let
him know that you wouldn't talk to him.
I said you're just missing the chance to taste a wonderful wine.
We sold in Oregon, and then Jerry Draper took our wine out in California.
Down in San Francisco.
The guy who owned Draper Vineyards, where I got my original Chardonnay, his son, was in the wine business, and he took our wines out in California, and I thought, boy, we got it made now. Pardon me. And the California response was ho-hum, and it still is pretty much.
But we got calls from lots of different places after the Beaune tasting.
We started in New York, too. We had calls from probably 20 distributors, and I check them out. Don't go with them. They'll never pay their bills. Finally, I got this one guy, Ian Rabowski, at Paramount Brands, and we're still with Paramount Brands, who sounded pretty decent. And a friend of his had called him and said, I tasted this wine of this idiot out in Oregon, and I think I want to handle it in my store. Would you clear it through your distribution? So Ian did it, and it started us in New York.
Going into the 1980s and, you know, that early part, you should turn around and do some Pinot Gris right in there.
Yeah,
okay.
I was going to.
Okay, we're on. Yeah.
Okay, let's see. So, the 80s took care of Pinot Noir, and people started flocking up here.
This is people to set up their wineries?
You bet.
Yeah, okay. Not just to buy.
No.
To do, well, maybe both. Okay. Go ahead.
And Pinot Gris, which we had grown Pinot Gris through the 70s from some of our original planting here. And it was never a wine that I was particularly turned on about because I was so focused on Pinot Noir. But I kept liking it. And it turned out that Pinot Gris was so good with salmon. And we have so had so much salmon in the Northwest. We used to trade our Pinot Gris production to salmon fishermen because we only made 25, 50 cases a year of it. And it was going over so well that I decided to butt over the Riesling, which I detested because it ripened too late for this climate. I was carrying boxes out with on my head with 4 inches of mud on my boots by the time we picked them. So I butted over all of the Riesling in our original planting.
Butted over, you mean took them out?
No, I sliced off the top of the Riesling and put in a bud.
Grafted.
Oh, okay.
Essentially grafted. So that gave us instantly about, what is it, 6 more acres of Pinot Gris. And then in 1979, we went in partnership with a good friend of mine, John Schettke, good friend of ours, out of a vineyard at the top of the hill here, which we now call Stonehenge. And that's all Pinot Gris, another 12 acres of Pinot Gris and an acre of Pinot Meunier. So we were beginning to get in the Pinot Gris production business, and in 1984 we went from 600 cases. We were at that point making 600 cases of Pinot Gris and barely selling it because no one knew what Pinot Gris was. Hell, most people didn't know what Pinot Noir was. And in 1984 we got this bumper crop, and it was the first year that the budded over vines came in big and Stonehenge came in big, and I had 3,000 cases, 5 times the production. And I thought, my God, this is going to take me 10 years to sell. And I went out into the market, and at that point, Ponzi and Adelsheim were growing Pinot Gris also. And we used to go, the three of us, go out on the road and do the, what we call the 2 days and a dick show. And talk about, well, first of all, we had to explain where Oregon was, you know, second down on the left. And then go into why we're in Oregon growing grapes, and then go into this grape no one had ever heard of, Pinot Gris. And at least in our case, I gave Pinot Gris away almost to get it on to in restaurants, in good restaurants where they taste it, where they pour it by the glass. Because I never found anyone who didn't love the wine. And it just took off. We had that 3,000 cases sold in a year and a half.
Isn't Pinot Gris basically the same as Pinot Gris here?
It's the same grape.
Yeah, so, I mean, if a place was not serving Pinot Grigio, then they wouldn't go to...
Pinot Grigio.
They didn't serve that much.
Okay, well, I'm from the East Coast, sorry.
Pinot Gris, Pinot Grigio, Blauburgunder, Ruländer in Germany, Tokaj Alsace or Pinot Gris in Alsace, Circa Bárd in Hungary. It's all over Northern Europe. But it was never planted commercially in the United States until right here. Uh-huh. And we made the first production of it right here. And Pinot Grigio at that point, no one had ever heard of it.
I don't think they were drinking that much back east.
And the Alsatian wines,
maybe
the
some.
Alsatian Pinot Gris were not, no. Alsatian Pinot Gris weren't going anywhere. And all of a sudden the Alsatians decided that Pinot Gris was really good with salmon. Wonder where they got that idea. And they started running with that. And Pinot Gris took off to the point now where it's the second largest selling white wine in the United States. Pinot Grigio, Pinot Gris. Gallo has planted, I think they're up to probably 20,000 cases. St. Michel is planting Pinot Gris out with a goal of 50,000 cases out east of the mountains.
Kenya State is huge.
Kenya State is big. They're at 60,000 cases of Pinot Gris, I think. But they're in the right climate. And bless Ed King, his advertising says, you can have Pinot Gris from other places, but it's not going to be Pinot Gris unless it comes from the Willamette Valley. And good for him. Because east of the mountains in that high desert plateau, Washington and Oregon have always sort of sorted it out. They grew varieties that were adapted over there, sort of like this old thing that I was talking about, Burgundy versus Bordeaux and so on. They grew later ripening varieties out there. But they're on this Pinot Gris bandwagon, and Gallo is on it. California is on it. We're talking about thousands of acres in the Central Valley of Chardonnay being torn out and planted to Pinot Gris. This is something I started in this country. Do I get a royalty? No.
Well, do you get recognition?
No.
Well, you get some recognition.
Yes. But it's an amazingly successful grape. But to follow up on Ed King's advertising, it's true. This grape, Pinot varieties are adapted to the Willamette Valley of Oregon. Maybe other places in the world. I remember when people used to tell me, grapes in Oregon? So, you know, there may be other places, but they're so limited because, again, this fragile varietal characteristic that Pinot Noir has, same thing in Pinot Gris. If it's in too warm a climate, poof, it's gone. And you get white wine. With Pinot Noir, too warm a climate, poof, you got red wine. But you don't have Pinot Noir or Pinot Gris. Mm-hmm. That's my life story.
Well, that only takes us to the middle of the 80s.
We're not even at International Pinot Noir Celebration. Or...
You don't participate in it?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
but
okay.
No. I was just that was, we're not even up to where that got started.
Oh, okay. You know, oh, I see what
that.
You mean.
Yeah.
You know, there's one thing that really ought to be injected in here, and that is I hear often that this is a young region. Oregon is a young region. We're as old as California's premium wine business. As I said before, there were three premium wineries in the Napa Valley in 1962. Americans did not start drinking more dry table wine than dessert wine until 1968. And California's premium wine business happened a number of years after I had come up here, actually. That's when people started drinking more table wine. And when varietals took off, and the spurrier tasting with Gurgitch and Warnarski that I mentioned earlier, that sort of set California going. And the Drouhin tasting set Oregon going. But there was nothing going on prior to 1968. Wine knowledge in the United States was, well, you remember going into restaurants. I remember when I was traveling, you'd get a bottle of Guild Tabola, if you were lucky, with the checkerboard label.
Well, it was pretty limited. I mean, there was the jugs of Gallo and Italian Swiss Colony. And I tasted Zinfandel in 1968, I think, at Italian Swiss Colony. And I couldn't get Zinfandel back in New York. They didn't, what were you talking about? I never heard of it before.
Right. There was nothing going on.
And, I mean, it's still, you know, people will get these things almond in a box.
Yeah, the whole food thing, too. I'm just now reading this book called The Soul of a Chef, and it's kind of all about the new food movement now and everything, but they keep talking about James Beard and Julia Child being the parents of good cooking in America. Yeah. And that all began to start in the mid-60s, and by the mid-70s, we had a revolution going in food and wine in this country. So. Yeah.
M.F.K. Fisher ought to be put in that.
And M.F.K. Fisher.
Yeah. I can remember the Chianti. I mean, in college, it was, you know, it was cheap stuff, but then when you're in college, that's what you could afford.
Would you drink Matisse Rosé in a little ceramic?
Oh, maybe.
Well,
maybe.
If you wanted a little ceramic jug for a candle.
Right. Flowers in it or something.
So, in the 80s, I guess the ball got rolling here in the 80s. And people started coming up here. By 85, things were really happening here. And in 87, a realtor in McMinnville by the name of John Rudehouse decided, you know him?
No, but I've heard the name mentioned. Okay. I interviewed Nick, and he mentioned that.
Okay,
name.
Well, Nick's probably giving you background.
No, you tell me.
He knows as much as I do. We were all in on it from the beginning. Nick's Italian Cafe is a story unto itself, too. I mean, that was the first decent restaurant north of San Francisco. When we lived in Silverton, we used to ask people what there was to do in Portland. They'd say, have you seen the zoo? And that was universal. That was all there was. There was one good restaurant in Portland, the Kitchen Kettle, Armenian food out on the east side. Mm-hmm. That was it that we liked.
Until Nick's L'Auberge. Well, L'Auberge.
Yeah, until
don't
L'Auberge.
Forget L'Auberge in Portland, yeah.
Yeah, Bill McLaughlin and... Mike Vidor started these restaurants, L'Auberge, Genoa, and the Wood Stove.
Yeah.
And that was the first good cuisine in Portland. And they were some of our first customers. Bill McLaughlin and Vidor showed up here at our door one day. One of those people we wanted to see at our door.
Yeah.
That was in 70, wasn't it?
1970.
right after we had produced the first wine.
They had just heard that grapes were growing here, and maybe there was some wine, and they wanted to come have it for the restaurant.
Time to change again. Okay.
So between Vidor and those folks up in Portland, that started the restaurant scene in Portland, and Nick here in McMinnville.
He was 1978.
78, yeah. And the back room at Nick's used to be where all of our kids played together. There was a basketball hoop there. There was no table. There were no tables back there. But God, what was the story? You tell it.
Well, I think that's where all of us, all kinds of people, artists and wine people and people interested in food, we were all kind of scattered around out in the woods in Yamhill County, you know. And then Nick's came, and we all found each other. And it was wonderful. We finally had a little community where a bunch of outsiders sort of fit, because we had all come from somewhere else. And we were all, you know, we weren't suspect because we'd been to college, and we weren't suspect because we drank wine. And so we fit. And that was a wonderful sort of beginning, I think, of our feeling of community. And it was a great place to hang out, and the kids all grew up together, all that sort of thing.
So and the symbiosis between
the food
good
and the
food
wine.
And good wine. Uh-huh.
And it really started an energy.
It did. I mean, we have restaurants in this county now that will rival anything in the world.
Really good.
Yeah. Because food follows wine. Wine is food. And, you know, where the two are grown together, where they exist together, you have this wonderful, wonderful thing. And Nick started this. I mean, he had the first good food north of San Francisco, truly. At least in this outback community here. And he started selling Oregon wines. And more winemakers, everyone would go to Nick's. And the symbiosis just happened. And Nick's used to sell more of our Pinot Gris than the entire state of Illinois.
Wow. I don't know. Does that say anything?
Yeah, it does. We had a good distributor.
Okay.
So International Pinot Noir Celebration started in 1987.
And that was John Rudhouse's brainchild, because he wanted to promote the area. He was a realtor. He wanted to promote the area for grape growing. And we soon...
so there was an ulterior motive.
Oh, yeah, it was definitely a real estate thing at first.
That was the initial grain, and all of us idealists decided, no, we're not going to play this game. We can have a legitimate event here that is not going to be competitive, that is not going to be a commercial event. It's just going to be fun and celebrate Pinot Noir. So it became the International Pinot Noir Celebration. Got to remember, again, Pinot Noir doesn't grow many places on this planet, and we happen to have one of them. So this thing, the first year, we were thinking, oh my God, are we going to be able to make it? And they get, 400 people?
Yeah, we need 400 people.
Sold out.
The idea was to bring people who produce Pinot Noir together. And so we had people from France, people from Oregon primarily, and then producers from other areas. So it really was international.
Yeah. Nick said you had people coming from Australia and Italy and Germany.
Just all over.
Chile, I'm not sure.
And chefs. Yeah. You know, we had a chef 1 year from France. We put on these dinners for 400 people. We had chef from, just various. Let's see, I think they did one. Alsace. Just everybody's been represented. And so it's like 15 or 16 years now it's been going on. Maybe longer.
Yeah, it sounds like it's
quite
a
deal.
It's
and now it's all lottery in January. You can't get in. It's jammed with people who would like to come, and it's been called one of the best wine events in the world.
Well, it's nice that it's here instead of, you know, in Europe.
And it had a dual thing of promoting, of getting the fellowship together, and it also had it promoted the Pinot Noir as a variety and brought a lot of recognition to that variety and a lot of interest. It inspired more interest in Pinot Noir.
Has it led to some of those people who came to the International Festival to then go to wherever they live or to move someplace else and start their own winery?
We saw a big increase in the production of Pinot Noir in California, big increase in New Zealand, in Australia. I mean, basically, it was kind of a kickoff for Pinot Noir.
Well, that was a good deal.
But, it, you know, people go, oh, right, sure. You know, you mean from McMinnville, Oregon? But it's true. I mean, it was a real, what do you call it, incubation festival for Pinot Noir. And it was exciting, really. And now this is a big deal, great variety
but
in the world.
But it's not that unheard of. I mean, I remember reading that Gilroy, California, decided to have a garlic festival once, and they hoped 300 people would come and 30,000 came. Gilroy?
But so to say that the Pinot Noir Celebration Festival inspired the growth of that of the Pinot Noir industry, it really did. And it certainly brought people here to come and grow grapes.
All right. So you participated from the beginning.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. David and I were... David was on the board for the first 10, 12 years. 10 years anyway. Yeah. And so that was the first big Pinot Noir event, and it's continuing.
And now we have the Oregon Pinot Camp, which you can also address. You're on the board.
No, we'll talk about that. So it was big excitement, and that's when the big money started coming in, too.
Okay, mm-hmm. Starting in the mid to late 80s.
Late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah. You know, we've doubled the wineries here since 1990.
Oh, they've doubled since I've been here, which is 8 years.
Yeah, it's just tremendous, the growth that's happened in the last little bit.
Let me ask a couple of questions that have not been answered in here. You tell me what you paid for this land per acre when you bought the first 20 acres over here. Have you bought beyond that land? Do you own more than those 20 acres?
Yeah.
Okay. What does an acre cost now, approximately?
I don't know. It depends on the acreage, of course.
Yeah.
The problem with the Willamette Valley, there are people who say there are hundreds of thousands of acres here that you can plant grapes on. Well, yeah, there are hundreds of thousands of acres around the world you can plant grapes on. But the ideal sites in the Willamette Valley are few and far between. And we have four, in all bias, ideal sites. So my feeling about our particular land and other pieces around here in the Willamette Valley, they should command premium prices. I mean, one of our vineyards is worth more money than this slope right across the street here. Mainly because it slopes the right way and the soil's better and there aren't rocks underneath it and yada yada.
All right, so I could talk to a realtor to get some
realtor will tell you, no, they're going to give you realtor talk.
You mean in terms of what it's
what is it?
It should depend on, is it south facing? What altitude is
it? Yeah, the specific and the soil type. I mean, we haven't started to differentiate a lot of these things. The realtors just sell anything to anyone. And have from the beginning. Land in the Napa Valley, for example, goes for minimum of $100,000 an acre. Land up here is probably $25,000-$30,000 an acre
For good grape land.
I'd push the limits up.
That's a reasonable response to that question. And so now, you've bought more land beyond that 20 acres in here. You jointly own a piece up here. Where else do you?
No, we, John Shetke and I, shouldn't say dissolved our partnership.
Well,
He wanted to move. He had a house up there. He wanted to move, and he just sold out the rest of the operation to me. So we have 100 acres total in the Dundee Hills, 50 of which are producing grapes.
And what are the other acres doing?
They're sitting there because at my age, I do not want to plant another 50 of acres of grapes because I would double my cost, double my labor, double my equipment, double my headaches. And as Diana said, add more zeros on this side and more zeros on this side. You don't get anywhere.
Well,
I'm comfortable with what our production is. I'd have to build a new winery. Forget it.
These other acres, that's 50 acres that are just sitting idle? They're not growing something else.
We have 12 acres of hazelnuts, and I should plant some other stuff, but the grapes tend to keep me rather busy.
Okay, so are you the person who does all the managing of the vineyards?
Yeah.
Do you work in the
No, I do office. And
I have a vineyard foreman who has been with me for 18 years, with us for 18 years, who is fabulous. And we have a crew of 6 people, including him, that we sort of keep employed year-round.
Oh, that's quite a lot.
In terms of, you ask if I manage the vineyard, I do the grand plan. You know, if we need to drop crop, they're not going to voluntarily knock off crop. They're going to be able
drop
to...
Drop crop meaning what?
Oh, prune off green clusters so you can get the rest of them ripe.
Okay.
Some years are like that up there.
So years are like it when you cut off some of the clusters so that you concentrate the sugar in?
Yeah. Like last year was a perfect example, 2002. People tend to go in fads unless they know what they're doing. So they follow these fads that you have to produce 1/10 of the acre to make the best Pinot Noir. Well, in a year like 2002, that's undercropping. That's not a balanced grape that comes off of there.
Here we go again. On to the last track.
Okay, so our 4 vineyards are the original planting here. This is Irie, named for the fir tree that's at the top of the vineyards where there was a nest of red-tailed hawks. Diana came up with that name. And that's a 20-acre piece. The next piece we bought was Stonehenge.
And that's fully developed.
It's fully planted. Stonehenge is fully planted. That's at the top of the hill.
And how many acres there?
Let's see. There's 15 acres total.
15?
15. Okay. And then in 87, we bought a place over where the two highways divide. It's called Three Sisters Vineyard. It has nothing to do with the mountains. It's Pinot Noir, Pinot Gris, and Pinot Blanc. They're all sister varieties.
So where the highway divides, where 99 and 18 separate? And
no, which... 99, we're going back toward Dundee, where it becomes 4 lanes.
Oh, okay.
If you look off to the left, you'll see grapes and hazelnuts up there. That's Three Sisters.
If you stay on Bremen Orchard Road and come Archery Summit, past Archery Summit Winery, and then down a little bit, it's right over in there.
Oh, they connect, okay.
Yeah, so, just below so we can summit. Go around this road and not take the equipment out onto the highway.
Everything's
really
within a mile. And the other vineyard is Rolling Green, which we bought in 1988. And that's a little 5 acres planted. It's a total of 30 acres, just up the hill from here. These are varying elevations, and these elevations are very important because the upper vineyard will ripen 2 weeks later than the lower vineyard.
Well, that can be a plus, can't it?
It is a plus.
I mean, they have it all coming in at one time.
Oh, it's fantastic. Right. And you can blend and jiggle around.
I could individually vineyard name these things, you know, what do they call it?
Single vineyard
designation. Single vineyard designation. I could easily do that, but we found that the whole is better than the parts. There are years when I could do it, but I think it's confusing to the consumer.
So what you put out is Irie, and it might be some from here
reserve.
And some from there and
yes,
some from there.
It will be a blend.
The reserve Pinot Noirs all come from the original planting, 37-year-old own-rooted vines. And the estate wines from the other vineyards, this Pinot Gris and Pinot Noir primarily, the Chardonnay and the Pinot Noir reserves, and the Chardonnay estate all come from this original planting.
Okay. So how much land is not in grapes now? Are we actually talking 50 acres? And you basically don't have plans for them. Is that what it comes down to? It's just a good investment. They're not making any more land.
And it'll be the next caretakers of the Irie vineyards, whether, you know, whoever that might be, who could plant more.
All right. Well,
we've reached our max.
Mm-hmm. And you've determined it's your max simply because of how much time you can put into it, is that it?
That and maintain the quality. I mean, I don't make wines to fit the market. I make wines that are rather idiosyncratic and have to be good to begin with from the beginning. And they require some selling. Although I'm seeing this thing turning around full cycle now, where people are beginning to rediscover Irie wines. We've got all this new frontier stuff, and now they're beginning to see some virtues in the style that originally attracted people to Oregon, which is our Pinot Noir and Pinot Gris. It sounds a bit arrogant to say that, but it is both arrogant and true.
Right. Well, at this point, there's 50 seconds left, so there's no point in actually starting any other discussion. But I will come back and ask to continue some of this. And one of the things is this new frontier stuff, because I'm not quite sure with this. So I'm going to just say this is the end of this tape, and we'll continue this.
I shouldn't have used the term new frontier. New kids on the block.